Howard is a British Greek Cypriot resident of Dubai and wears a number of hats: a restaurant reviewer, food writer, PR practitioner, and event organizer. Now, having left the hospitality PR world, she set up her own business in Dubai 8 years ago, an impartial restaurant review website, Foodiva. And she's our guest on this week's Esquire Q&A podcast. Samantha, thank you so much for joining us in the Esquire studio for a very special edition of Foodiva and Esquire's Q&A podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've been on a lot of amazing culinary adventures recently, haven't you?
I have. I started the summer with a trip to Thailand. It was actually, the intention was doing a wellness break, which I did, but I preceded that with a dinner at Gagan. So that for me was probably my best culinary experience ever. And I'm so glad I did it, because he's just closed it and he's looking to reopen again in a few months. But yeah, that was fabulous. It was a real case of really injecting fun into dining. I did the chef's table experience. So his emoji menu, every dish is paired with a different rock tune. My husband loves his music, so he was in his element. It was 4 hours, and I didn't want it to end. Yeah.
That's like my dream food destination. If I'm ever in Bangkok, you know, Gagan, he's made a name for himself, obviously, as world's 50 best Asian chef, but he's also sort of inspired a whole new generation of chefs, I think, to create, you know, amazing tasting menus.
Yeah. And it is, and some people say, oh, of tasting menus passé, are they over? And I think there's a time and a place for everything. Now, I could not eat at Gagan's even once a month, would be too much. But as a special occasion experience, it's fantastic. And you can't replicate that anywhere.
I think tasting menus are designed to be, like you said, an experience. And an experience has its time and place. You can't do it every day. Mm. It just makes it all that special.
Yeah.
You know, to do it once every, you know, or just once in your life, or once every year, or every couple of months. I don't know. It kind of takes the magic away for me if you do a tasting menu.
It's also like, if you go out for dinner every night of the week, you get bored of it. And I still firmly believe that dining out should be a special experience. But yes, going back to Gaga, I mean, the beauty of it is he was there as well. And I'm not sure it would have been as amazing if he wasn't, because he was entertaining us, stories around every single dish. And he's, as you know from his Instagram, he's very vocal. And you see the real person behind it. It's not scripted in any way.
No, he was lovely. I think that's where we met for the first time
it is,
in
actually,
Dubai as well, when he was in Dubai, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's he has no, I asked him actually about Dubai, has no intention of opening here.
Oh, that's a shame.
But, you know, he's obviously had opportunities and lots of money thrown at him, but he's decided he doesn't want that. He wants to focus on other things. And I gather now with the new venture, because he's fallen out with his current investors and hence why he's reopening somewhere else, that Japan is no longer on the cards.
Oh, I thought that was his next big move.
He said on his last Instagram post, he's explained that that's...
Ah.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So instead, he's going to focus on a new Gagan somewhere else, new location in Bangkok.
So you truly ate at his restaurant at the best time.
Yeah, it was, he wasn't meant to close until next year. It was beginning of July, and he closed last week, or earlier this week, actually. Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, that's good then, that you got
yes,
to taste
Gagan.
I know.
And I wasn't sure whether I was going to get a booking or not, because the way it works, you go online, and you request, like with a lot of these restaurants, and then they let you know 3 weeks before whether you've been successful or not.
I mean, your Instagram gives me, you know, food envy. Honestly, you know, in Cyprus last week, you were posting amazing pictures of, you know, Greek food, Cypriot food, you know, different kinds of drinks. And honestly, it does give me a little bit of food envy, because I'm sitting at my desk at work being like, gosh, Samantha gets to eat really amazing food. And it just looks absolutely beautiful on your Instagram as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting now since stories have become such a bigger focus. And I'm sure you've seen it as well. I mean, I post less on my actual feed than I do on stories. To be honest, I actually probably post less on social generally now than I did a year ago because I'm focusing on a lot of other projects. And also I'm very conscious of the fact that the website is still a priority for me because I think we have to remember that we don't own any of these social media channels. So I don't want to put my whole business on Instagram because they can shut it down tomorrow. And we've seen very high profile cases where accounts have been shut down, or Instagram may go and it will morph into something else at some point. So I'm very focused on the fact that you need to obviously use social media because that's what people are looking at, but it's just one or two or three of a number of different channels. And I'm very selective about what I post. For me, it's food only. I'm a private person. I don't like sharing my personal life. I think there's a reason it's called personal life or private life. So I don't get overwhelmed with all of that. So if there's something interesting to post food wise, and it's either a really great experience or a really bad experience, and there's some kind of a photo that I can get out of it or a video, then yes, I'll post it. Yeah.
So as a UAE's resident food expert, what are the places that are on your list as some of, you know, the best experiences in the UAE right now?
I don't have a favorite restaurant per se, but I do this annual guide of my sort of top places to dine out, which is a bucket list guide because I get a lot of requests. I mean, that essentially is the number one question I get asked. And rather than sort of reel off a number of restaurants, I share this guide and I usually update it at the beginning of the year to reflect basically what's happened the year before. And if I had to pick, I'll pick a number of, in the current guide, there's, I think it's 26 restaurants and it covers licensed and unlicensed. I'll pick the five, which are also the five that I included in the Truth, Love and Clean Cutlery book, which is a global restaurant guide that launched at the end of last year, edited by Giles Corran, who's the Times food critic. And they worked with contributors, food writers around the world to basically assemble what are the best, most ethical, most sustainable restaurants around the world. And this is about neighborhood restaurants. This isn't about necessarily tasting menu experiences, even though if there is a contribution to the community, that could make the cut. So the brief for me here was to pick five restaurants. And the process for that, I think this is really important because this isn't just about me picking my favorites, is that these restaurants had to fill in a very detailed online questionnaire answering a number of different questions around their food, their sourcing, their staff training. And that was then vetted by myself and then a global sort of editorial team. So the five restaurants that are in that are also reflected in my annual guide. I'll start with the two unlicensed ones, actually. Baker and Spice. Primarily, I think probably the Souq al-Bahar location because of the fountains there.
It's a beautiful view.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you have to go there for breakfast because I think their standout dish is the shakshuka. No one can beat that shakshuka in Dubai. Others have tried, but no one can do it. Both the tomato version and the kusa, the marrows as well. It's just sensational. I've even ordered it at home, believe it or not, because I discovered a few months ago that it was on Deliveroo.
Does it deliver well, though?
You know, obviously it's not the same. And the eggs, by the time they arrive, are a little bit too cooked for me. But, you know, if you haven't got anything at home or you've suddenly got people coming over and you need something, it's brilliant because it comes with all the sourdough bread and everything. So that's Baker and Spice. Then Three Fills. Chef Akmal's place at Jumeirah Fishing Village. And again, there, I mean, it's wonderful if you can do the chef's table experience, but even just sitting there and ordering off the menu.
I think that's one of the most underrated restaurants in Dubai. I mean, obviously, it's very well known from, you know, the foodie audience. Yeah. And that's where I take, you know, every time someone's visiting or we just feel like, you know, going for a bit of a low-key evening, we'll go there. But I feel like not enough people are talking about it.
Do you know, it's interesting you say that because I would, if you'd said that a year ago or maybe a year and a half, I would have agreed with you. But I do think he's had a lot of press. Since then, I think, yes, he very much and by his own admittance struggled in the beginning, but I think he's getting his fair share now. Maybe a little bit because it's not licensed and that kind of food would really pair well. But he has his demographic, he has his customer base. And that also probably prefer the fact that it is unlicensed as well.
And the food is great.
The food is fantastic. Yeah, and it's healthy. It's very interesting what he does, and because he does different specials. I mean, I love what he does with the uni. Yeah, he's extremely talented, and I really think he's shown that has come through in this. In his own operation. And all these restaurants as well, I mean, to highlight, they're all homegrown. And actually, even in the bigger guide of 26 restaurants, I think there are only two imported brands in there. So going on to three licensed restaurants, BB Social Dining at DIFC, Chef Alex Stumpf, Spiro and Shab, who's Alex's wife, they opened it coming up to 2 years, actually, in November. And it's a modern sort of Pan-Asian stroke Far Eastern restaurant, the place for bao buns. They bake them overnight in the restaurant.
And I'm so glad you took me there because honestly, that was the best bao bun I've possibly had since I moved to Dubai 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
They everyone else cooks from frozen, which is why they are brilliant. It's very hard for me to order a bao bun from another menu because I know that they're not going to be made fresh overnight. And you have to eat the bao bun. So it's like going to a pizzeria. You'd eat pizza. You wouldn't order anything else. But it's charming because it's hidden away as well. And the decor, it's got this lovely sort of dollhouse feel to it, sort of very Parisian. And then we also have at DIFC, just around the corner, Bocca, which has been a favorite since it opened. And that's for Spanish tapas. They've got a wonderful working wine cellar, which you can use for private gatherings. And I've had sort of dine arounds there as well. It's a very, very quaint.
It's like a lesser known fact.
Yeah. And it's very, and yeah, exactly. Not a lot of people know that because private dining rooms I find here are very sterile. Another exception is Il Boro that has a beautiful private dining room. So you actually cut away from the rest of the restaurant, and you might as well eat at home then. If you're going to book a private dining room, it really needs to engage all the senses. And Bocas does because it's actually a working wine cellar as well. And you're literally surrounded by all of that. And last but not least, Folly. Now, that was also, disclosure, my wedding party venue. But this all went to print well before all of that. You know how books work. It's like you write everything a year before you actually see anything. Love that for it's Sundowners. I think what Nick and Scott are doing there is it's very playful. Again, they've rather than sort of tell you, okay, you need to order three courses. They basically have a menu of different dishes and you can sort of pick and mix, really. But I would definitely go. I do think it is a venue for the winter months because it's a shame not to go there and have Sundowners on the rooftop terrace.
That terrace is beautiful, overlooking the Madinat especially. And their food is exceptional.
Yes, yeah. They're classic. You know, they're Gordon Ramsay trained guys. They're very sort of classic. And you can see, I think, even to this day, you can still see that coming through in his dishes. Yeah.
Have you been to their new restaurant?
To Verve. I have, because it's actually, well, it's very near us here as well, but it's, when the weather's nice, I could walk it in 20 minutes. But it's sort of open just as it was beginning to get hot. So, yeah, I've only been a couple of times.
I think enough time to get the processes in place before the winter months start, I think.
Exactly. I gather they're doing really well with their brunch. I haven't tried it yet, though.
So, you know, Dubai is a place that has restaurants opening, closing, new restaurants being announced all the time. Have there been any announcements made in the last year that have made you, you know, perk up and be like, actually, I'm really excited to try that out when it opens?
You know, it's really hard to get excited about new restaurant openings, because sometimes I see things in my inbox and I go, God, not another restaurant opening. And I guess I'm probably a little bit disillusioned, having been doing this now for 8 years. So I tend not to get too excited until I perhaps read in a little more to it. I also feel I don't want that to affect my expectations when I go in and review, because I've got to keep an open mind. What is a real bugbearer, though, is if I see a restaurant literally on social media constantly because they've invited people left, right and center, I'll steer away from it. Because I think it's evident there that people have been invited and they're just sharing material because they've been invited and not necessarily being opinionated in what they're sharing. So that tends to put me off, and I might go in later on, or I might just, drop it completely. But there have been three sort of standout openings for me this year. I do feel, though, that when it comes to the quality this year versus last year, it's gone down.
Has it?
Yeah. And which is one reason, and this isn't something I've really shared publicly, but I've moved away from my regular dine around to the three chefs dinner concept, because the dine around is based on three new restaurants in relative close proximity of each other, because you obviously want to spend more time eating than getting from A to B. And I've struggled to come up with three new restaurants in one district.
Is it all too spread out?
So I can find three new restaurants in town that I'm happy to take guests to, but they're spread apart.
So you said the quality has gone down.
Yeah, I do think this over the last year, the quality's gone down on that front. And that's one of the reasons I then sort of changed that concept. It was something I was thinking about, the three chefs dinner concept anyway. It had always been at the back of my mind as a twist on the dine around. But, and I also want to be able to showcase restaurants that are not necessarily new, and chefs that are not necessarily new to the market. Because everyone deserves press or deserves their own marketing. And actually, it's the smaller concepts, the ones that are not fronted by a big hotel or have big marketing budgets, and the independents that need that kind of support.
So why, according to you, do you think the quality's gone down this year versus the last year?
Perhaps not enough attention to detail in terms of that operation. I think we've seen a lot of restaurants open that are passion projects. And there's no business plan behind it. It's not well thought through.
My biggest pet peeve, though, with restaurants that open is that they rent out a massive space, and Dubai is such a small city.
Yeah.
You know, you can't sometimes get 350 covers a night, every single night, for 7 days a week. No. I wish, but this is me personally, as a diner, I don't want to sit in an empty restaurant. I want to,
you might as well order in.
Yeah. feel the buzz of the city is something I feel like. Do you think there are just too many restaurants opening up where people just are focusing on the opening date and not necessarily the concept or the project or attention to detail or, you know, how can we make this different?
Yeah. I do think there is a huge focus on the interior. And yes, massive restaurants, rather than looking at sort of a smaller restaurant that's more charming, less covers. So yeah, they're definitely focused more on that rather than the food and the service. But I also think sometimes they get the food right and they forget about the service as well.
Do you think Dubai, though, has an obsession with celebrity restaurants? We've seen, you know, Heston Blumenthal announce that he's opening up at the New Atlantis. We've heard news of, or not news, but Alain Ducasse has opened up at Emerald Palace, Kempinski. Gordon Ramsay's opened up at Caesars, Blue Waters. And a lot more celebrity chef announcements have been made saying that, you know, they're excited to open in Dubai. Is there a bit of an obsession in the industry right now?
I mean, the names that you mentioned, yes, that's correct. And Atlantis has got, I mean, all their new concepts coming up in the new Atlantis are big names. And I think you're always going to have hotels like Atlantis do that. And that's fine. But I think we've actually moved away from that now. There aren't, other than the names you mentioned. I mean, yes, you've got Heinz Beck that's still here. Pierre Garnier's come back, but in a much smaller way with a bistro. You don't have any big name chefs here anymore. Not on the scale that we did 7-8 years ago. And I think Dubai needed that at the time to help put Dubai on the culinary map. But we've moved away now. We are seeing so many locally developed concepts, whether that's cafes. I mean, you look at the micro districts of Barsha, of Jumeirah, or sort of JLT, up to the sort of high-end licensed restaurants, like the, some of the concepts that I've just mentioned earlier. There is a real opportunity there, and that gap is being filled. And that's a sign of a maturing market, ultimately. So, yes, it's definitely changing, and I expect we're going to see a lot more of that and less reliance on the celeb chef.
I think that'll be nice for, you know, people in the restaurant business to see that, you know what, actually, it's not just a celebrity chef name that draws crowds into openings. It's also a local chef who's put in his time, who's put in his effort in the industry. Mm-hmm. Like you look at, you know, like you said, some of the chefs who've been here for the past decade, like Nick and Scott, they've really evolved in this market, you know? And I think that that's what the city needs now, a little bit of.
Definitely. And I think there's a real hunger from the residential population to support these. They also tend to be more affordable. I mean, that's one thing we have to bear in mind. Even though, I have to say, in defense of the big brands, I did a comparison with two. It's at the beginning of the year because I was getting a lot of feedback from people. Oh, but Dubai is so much more expensive than everywhere else. And it is when it comes to alcohol. I think we're all agreed on that front. But I compared Hakkasan and Hell's Kitchen here with Hakkasan London, which has a Michelin star, and Hell's Kitchen in Las Vegas. The price point of the food, bearing in mind it's identical menus, was exactly the same, bar 1 or 2 dirhams per dish. And in some cases, Dubai was cheaper. I mean, it's 1 or 2 dirhams as well. So the price is the same when it comes to food. But unfortunately, once you add the alcohol component to it, that's where it rises.
I also think in cities like New York and London, you eat out rarely. It's either a special occasion or, you know, an important event in your life. In Dubai, let's face it, we all eat out a lot.
Well, it's an expat society. We don't have family here. Our family are our colleagues at work or friends that we've made here. And we tend to, especially in a city like Dubai, when you have so much choice. I think if you live in somewhere like Al Ain or Ras Al Khaimah, they tell you, no, we actually go around to people's houses. But here we do eat out. And it's almost because there is so much happening. If you're a foodie, you want to go and try it. And it's not the same as ordering in, even if that element is cheaper because you can then drink at home.
Though to be fair, you know, ordering in as well has become very expensive here.
Yes. Yeah. And it's quite addictive with all these apps as well, because they do make it very easy.
Yeah. You know, at the push of a button, you have lunch delivered to the office or you have dinner delivered home. It's not, you know, it doesn't make it easier.
I think the challenge is supermarket shopping is expensive here. So if it's just one or two of you at home, you're better off ordering a roast chicken and having it delivered with everything rather than making that. Because to go and buy that and everything, the accompaniments, is going to cost you a lot more. Obviously, if you're cooking for a family of four or five, then yes. But that's also, a challenge.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong. When I first moved to Dubai 4 years ago, you know, I started to notice this thing that the city does with its restaurants. Dubai restaurants pick a cuisine and then it just mushrooms into a number of openings. We've seen Peruvian, we've seen Greek, we've had Indian in the past. What's the current, you know, trend that's, you know, taken over Dubai's food industry?
Well,
right now?
You know, I mean, just touching on the Greek thing. I mean, I'm half Greek Cypriot, so a little bit biased. But a few years ago, I said, because we only had Elia and then we had Mythos when it came to licenses. I said, oh gosh, wouldn't it be nice to have just a bit more choice when it comes to Greek? I'm sure it would really work here. And lo and behold, in the space of 6 months, we had six new licensed Greek restaurants. So I'm very skeptical about predicting cuisines. I'm not one, to be honest, for predict, because, you know, you could pick anything, really. But I'll tell you what I'd like to see and where I really think there is a gap in the market here is modern Middle Eastern high-end licensed restaurants. And I'll mention Kubara. I was very vocal and still am very vocal that if I ever had a favorite restaurant in Dubai, that was it. I cried the day I heard it was closing down. Sadly, the location didn't work because everyone in Dubai is so lazy, so they don't want to travel an extra 10 minutes past downtown to get to Wafi. But we need, when we go to Italy, we'll eat pizza. When we go to Japan, we'll eat sushi and sashimi. When people come here, they'll eat all of that, but they won't eat food from this region. Because it's not, we don't give people enough choices. They might eat the odd shawarma on a hotel buffet. And yes, we do have a lot of Levantine and sort of broader Middle Eastern concepts, but they're more casual. We don't have enough that's high end. We have Neneve actually, and that's going to be the venue for my next Three Chefs dinner because the theme's going to be modern Middle Eastern because, again, it's something I really want to embrace and to showcase. But we need more of that here. And I think there is a real gap here for that.
Do you think there's going to be anything interesting on that front coming up anytime soon?
Not that I'm aware of, but we might see it. I don't know. I'd like to. I mean, I'm very vocal about it. Others are vocal about it as well. I mean, I hear feedback from restaurateurs that the reason that doesn't work is, and we saw Greg Maloof that came in with Sahir, and Greg's a very talented chef, and he's going to be at my next Three Chefs dinner. But he hasn't had much success here with the two restaurant concepts that he had. And the struggle is, I think, because when people go in to try that cuisine, people from the region, they're saying, but it's not like my mother's food. And of course it's not like your mother's food because we want to make it different and it's a modern take on it. And the Greeks have the same thing when they go into these Greek restaurants. I can understand that when they see ceviche on the menu because we don't have ceviche in Greece. We don't eat raw fish, full stop. So I can understand that a little bit. But if we don't embrace modernity and innovation in cuisine, we're going to be eating the same thing now that we're eating in 20 years' time. And surely we've obviously moved on and we're no longer eating what we were eating 20 years ago. So I think we do have to be more open-minded about it.
I think that's a very interesting point that you've raised. Is there any Middle Eastern place that, you know, is at the top of your list in terms of the ones doing something interesting right now that our readers possibly should try?
Yeah, I do think Nineveh, and that's why I've picked it as the venue. I love the fact, I mean, the setting, going back to what we said earlier, yes, the setting is stunning, but you have to go. My event's not going to be until November because I want the weather to cool down so that you can enjoy the outdoor setting. Because at the moment they have a sort of air conditioned tent, which still makes it very cozy, but obviously you're not out in the open air under a starlit sky. But it's got atmosphere there as well, in terms of the music, and an electric oud player. But the food there, you have Gilles, who is also the exec chef at La Cantine du Faubourg. He's got Soufiane, who's the Syrian chef de cuisine there. And it's a broader Middle Eastern restaurant. So they're not specific to one cuisine. You see a lot of sort of Moroccan, Iraqi influences, Levantine, obviously, as well. It's not modern in the way Kubara was modern. But it is a different take on it. And I do think it's if you've got one night in Dubai, take visitors there. I think what Colin has done at Ruya as well, it's Turkish, so it's slightly, not specifically Middle Eastern, depending on which countries fall under that. But he was obviously the chef at Kubara. He's got a real talent in terms of adapting himself to different cuisines. And like what he did at Kubara was he surrounded himself with people from the region, asked them to recreate their childhood dishes, and then he took those dishes and put his own spin on them. And you can see what he's also done at Ruya. I mean, that's also a real sort of destination restaurant as well. And then you have some smaller cafes here. I think places like Beit Mariam, perhaps in JLT, sort of Palestinian Lebanese food. It's great for breakfast, but nothing on a sort of a large scale, really.
Now, the cafe culture in Dubai has really sort of, you know, it's been here for a while. There are lots of interesting cafes that have opened up very recently. What are some places where you'd happily spend the entire day there?
I'd have to go back to Baker and Spice, which obviously has been open a long time. I think you have seen a lot of cafes there. I mean, personally, I'm not. See, I have an office at home. I get easily distracted. I cannot go and work in a cafe. I really can't, because I wouldn't get any work done. I'd just be looking around, taking pictures. I think it's great if you've got a whole day of meetings and you can get everyone to come and meet you in that place, because that saves you time. But I tend to go to people more than people tend to come to me. So I'm probably not the best person to ask that question. But I do obviously go to cafes on weekends. And I think we've got some fabulous concepts in Alcoz. I tried Cassette recently, it's a good few months ago. There are obviously a lot on the beach road. You have the likes of Bistro that have been there in Al Manara. I'm a big fan of Jones the Grocer. I know it's not a local concept, but since they changed the menu, it's a fantastic menu. And that cheese room, I can't go in there without buying any cheese, which is probably why I wouldn't go and work there in the daytime, because I'd walk out with cheese every time.
Now, you eat out a lot, obviously. It comes with the job. What are some of your pet peeves when you go out in and the restaurant's crowded and, you know, the diner sitting next to you is just
too close? Yeah.
Too close? Is that one of your pet peeves at a restaurant?
You know, it depends. I mean, you look at the likes of La Petite Maison. I mean, you couldn't get tables more closer together. personally, I do like a bit of space, but, you know, I'd rather have a busy restaurant than an empty restaurant. But when it comes to pet peeves, it tends to be on service more than anything. Again, I wrote about it a good few years ago because I had a terrible experience where the food was actually okay, but the service was just catastrophic. It was sort of faulty-esque, really, that I ended up writing a piece on what are all my sort of service pet peeves. But I think things like, for me, that really annoy me is a waiter repeating your order. As far as I'm concerned, get it right the first time. I don't want to hear you repeating it. Why? You're wasting my time. Also, I don't like being explained too much about the restaurant concept. You know, I'm here to eat. The restaurant, the concept should sell itself. Maybe partly a little bit biased because I've obviously done my research. But, you know, other people say that as well. It's not just me. I mean, if it's something that's going to take just one quick sentence, fine. But I don't want to hear hours and hours of what this concept is. Not leaving the menu with me and taking it away, even when I've said, can you please leave it? And then they take it and then I'm looking for it and it's not there and I've got to ask for it. Asking for the bill or trying to get the bill, but you can't get the waiter's attention. But they're over attentive and they're there all the time, interrupting your conversation to say, how are things going? I think there's a real art, and that's where you see that in really good restaurants versus other more mediocre ones, in terms of knowing when to approach a table and when is the right time to, because obviously you do want someone to come at some point and say, is everything okay? Or how did you like that dish? Or actually to relate it perhaps to something that you've said earlier, like, oh, I really want to try this particular fish. What would you recommend? And then to come back and say, oh, what about that dish? Did that tick the expectations there?
Mine is when, you know, they serve you the food and then they stand over your shoulder and observe every single, you know, like, yeah, or stare at you shoveling mouthfuls of food, you know, in the sense, yeah, that it's, they are being overly, you know, attentive, and it's nice that they're interested in there for me if I need anything, but not necessarily just, you know, standing behind and observing, yeah, every little thing that you do. I don't know. For me, I think that completely,
yes,
puts
there's
me
a off. There's a real fine balance in between making sure they're being attentive but not intrusive. And again, only a handful of restaurants, yeah, do get that right. The other pet peeve, actually probably my biggest one, we'll talk about this for hours, is removing one person's dish when the rest of the table has not finished. That is so rude. And to the point now that I actually say, no, I haven't finished yet, because they haven't finished yet. And then they're sort of taken aback and off they go. Yeah.
But why do you think that is? Is it, do you think there's just not that much attention to service?
You know, I think it goes back to, and actually one point worth bringing up is, are restaurant managers and maitre d's, if that word still exists, I don't think it does, but I would like to think it's still there, paid as much as the executive chef? Probably not. I think they should be, because service and food are equal prerequisites to a dining experience. In fact, if, as long as the food is okay, I always say this with licensed restaurants, more high-end restaurants, as long as the food is okay, if the service impresses, you'll be back. But if the service is rude, you're not coming back.
Even if the food is good.
Even if the food is good.
Yeah.
But you can let one or two dishes may not be quite right. But you'd still go back if the service is impressed as well. So yeah, I mean, going back to, I think there is, yeah, a lack of talent, a lack of training. Their staff turnover is very high here. So that's obviously a challenge in all of that. But because of the pay, the tipping structure, something that I wrote about recently for your sister publication, Hotelier, People will jump ship just for 200 or 300 more dirhams a month. And obviously they'll go to the busier restaurants where they're more likely to get more tips as well. So I do think it stems from above. I think it's unfair for us to blame the individual waiter there. Also, actually, one thing on that, and again, you see it with the better restaurants. The better restaurants hire for personality and train everything else in. None of this yes, madam, no, madam culture, because you can train etiquette in service in, but you can't train personality.
You know, also another thing you brought up in the previous point was tipping culture. You know, we tend to tip in the US and the UK and Europe and, you know, anywhere else in the world, India even. The UAE, not so much. I don't, do you think that there's like, because everything is expensive, people don't tip enough?
You know, that's a good point, actually. I think there is a little bit of a backlash because people are going into restaurants and thinking, oh my goodness, yes, this is already expensive because you add that alcohol and that bill has tripled. So yes, I think there's part of it. But I think it goes back to the fact that people don't know that when if service charge is added to the bill, and not all restaurants, it's essentially the hotel-based restaurants that add service charge to the bill. And you'll either see it as a total at the end or it will be included in the dishes. If they see service charges added, they think waiters are getting that service charge. They're not. That service charge does not go to the waiters or waitresses. It goes towards team-building activities. It goes towards breakages. So indirectly, it might benefit them, but it's not cash in their pocket or added to their salary at the end of the month. So unless you tip, they don't get anything extra. So I think it's partly lack of disclosure on the behalf of the restaurants and the hotels. They're not disclosing that. So frankly, if you think there's a service charge there, you'd think service goes towards the service staff. I mean, it also, strictly speaking, should be split between service and front of house and kitchen, because obviously the kitchen's put a lot of work into that as well. But from what I can understand, it tends to be 70% service versus 30% kitchen, which might be fair given they're not paid as well. So yeah, it probably balances itself out.
Now, coming back to some of the new openings this year, can you name three of your favorite new openings that people must try?
So I've got three, actually. I did give it some thought before coming here. So three very different concepts. They're all licensed, these three, because I think ultimately, obviously, when you're going to a licensed restaurant, you're paying more, so you want to get it right. If you go to a cafe and you spend 100 dirhams and it's not quite right, you'll forgive them for it. But when you're going to high-end restaurants, you want to make sure you're going in for a really special experience. So in no particular order, Alici, have you tried it?
I have.
So I've been a fan of Il Borro since it started, but I really think they've created something different with Alici. And Alici is locally developed as well. It's a Italian seafood concept from the south of Italy, very much Amalfi inspired. And that whole team, from the chef to the restaurant manager to the sort of the key service team, they're all from the Amalfi coast. And it was actually, they obviously did work with a designer, but they actually went there as a team to actually be inspired, both for the decor and obviously the food as well. And you really see that. I think they're fried anchovies. So Alici stand is translates into anchovies in Italian. And that for me is their standout dish. You don't often get anchovies here either. But I think that's very special. It's a blue water. So obviously once the eye opens, I went just as it was getting too hot. So I didn't fully appreciate the setting and didn't sit on the terrace. But it's a beautiful venue, both for lunch and for dinner.
I'm actually waiting to go back once the temperature's cool, because just, you know, walking from the marina across the new Blue Waters
Bridge. That's amazing. You know,
and it's a beautiful, I did it a lot in the winter.
Did you? But, right. Okay.
But obviously, you know, it builds the anticipation, you know, like in London or New York where you're working and then you, you know, get down and you walk and then you have a great meal with a beautiful view. And I think that's, you know, once the temperature's cool, that's what I'm waiting to do with the lychee.
No, it's I can't wait to go back when the weather cools down as well. But having said that, because it's so light in there, it's so much white and those touches that of that sort of Amalfi blue, even sitting inside is beautiful. And you can't help but just look around you because it's, I mean, they have spent a lot on the decor, but it's not at the expense of everything else.
Yeah. And I find that, you know, sometimes when restaurants spend too much on decor but don't focus on the food equally enough, there's kind of, you see the gap.
Yes.
And I think this is a case where they've done both beautifully. Yeah. So what are the other two restaurants?
So the other two, I've got India by Vineet, actually, Vineet Bhatia's restaurant. And actually, I don't consider Vineet, because he practically lives here. I don't consider him an internet. I mean, he is an international chef, but, and obviously has a celebrity chef name. But because he spends so much time here, both him and his wife, who manages his business, I think he's pretty much based here. But I adore this concept. It's comfort food. It's all his childhood. Again, have you tried it? Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. But it's his childhood dishes reinvented. One of my favorite dishes is actually a vegetarian dish. It's the roasted tandoori cauliflower, the whole cauliflower with tahini sauce and pomegranate. Oh my goodness. It's in a hotel. It's a little bit touristy in terms of the clientele. Very busy, whatever night of the week you go. It's got a little bit of a sort of terrace area, but it's more of an indoor venue. Sort of very charming sort of street food sort of murals.
I love the decor. Yeah, I love how bright it is and how exciting.
And very affordable. Yeah. I mean, you can eat there for 150, 170 dirhams a head, food only. It's really well priced.
And good food.
Yeah. And the menu, I mean, I know a little bit about Indian food because my parents lived there for a while. But even I struggled a little bit because, and that's one tip I said to them. I said, you need to translate some of those dishes on the menu because it just gives the Indian name for it.
Yeah.
And unless you're Indian, you wouldn't necessarily know what they mean. But they said that they wanted the staff to be able to explain it. But then that goes back to my thing. I actually don't want the staff to explain it. I just want to know. But maybe that's me. And my third one is an obscure one called Fujiya.
Really?
Have you come across it?
No.
It's a Japanese izakaya, which essentially is a Japanese pub. It's at the Airport Millennium. And it opened a few months ago, but I only recently went before the summer and I was just gobsmacked. It's very obscure. It's got a separate entrance to the hotel. It's next to the ballroom. It's very casual. I mean, you'd walk in there. I mean, they just designed it in-house. There's no design element to it. But it's just a standard pub, but with really good Japanese soul food. Street food, lots of fried dishes. But having said that, you get all the healthy stuff, the sashimi. They do a lot of shabu shabu there as well. They do a fantastic deal on Fridays and Saturdays, anytime between 12 and 9 p.m., any 3-hour period, they have their sort of brunch deal. But the menu, they have 5 different menus littered with typos. I mean, things like that would be another bugbearer, but you let them off for it because the food is fantastic. The service is great. It's a Japanese businessman that came here specifically to open this and to give something back to Dubai that it didn't have. Because you have the high-end restaurants, you have the likes of Zuma. And they're doing so well. It's rammed with Japanese. They're now scouting for a location in Dubai Marina. But it's, again, really affordable. That's 150 cool. dirhams a head. I cannot stop raving about it. Yeah.
The thing about Japanese restaurants is you know it's authentic if there are Japanese customers. Yeah. And are there Japanese yes. customers?
And actually, obviously when I went in, I was completely anonymous. So it's only if I go back that I then get to know them. And I have been, it's probably the only restaurant that I have ever reviewed here that I have been back so frequently in the first month since that review ran. Because, and bizarre, and it's the other side of town of me. The location's not convenient. I have been doing a lot of airport runs, so that helps. But it was round with Japanese the night I went. And I was a little bit dressed up because I think it was a Thursday night and I like to dress up. But honestly, I felt so out of place because you can walk there in flip-flops and shorts, really. It's not the kind of place you would dress up. But it was full of Japanese. And actually, having met the manager afterwards, that was their strategy. They said they didn't want to do any marketing. They said, we're just going to liaise with the embassy here. We're going to target the Japanese community. He knew you had Kiku at the airport Meridian. And they do say that any restaurateur that opens Japanese, the team behind Tomo will testify to that as well. And actually, the person that told me this, if you find a location near the airport, that will really work for the Japanese. And it was around, you even had people, you could see Japanese people with their suitcases either just on their way to the airport or just landed. So they wanted to get the Japanese community, fill it in, because then if the expats go and see the Japanese, they're going to go, oh my God, it must be amazing. And then now he's looking to sort of widen that now. And actually, interestingly, he told me his demographic, as a result of my review and all the different posts that I've, because I've been back, so is now his demographic has changed to 60% expat, 40% Japanese.
Oh, wow.
So he's getting more of the
Dubai crowd.
It's a tiny place. I mean, he could double the size. I mean, there's a terrace which obviously is closed at the moment, so it's a bit of a redundant space. So I'm sure if he opens in the right location, this side of town, they will do quite well.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your three options with us, Samantha. And thanks so much for joining us on the Esquire Q&A podcast.
Thank you very much. I've loved it. Really enjoyed it.
Perfect. So if our readers want to contact you, how do they do that?
Well, my website is foodiva.net with one D. I'm on Instagram as @foodiva and on every other social media channel as Foodiva World.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Samantha.
Thank you very much.
And that wraps up this episode of the Esquire Q&A podcast. As always, don't forget to hit subscribe so you get a new podcast every single week.